president of AHA, and welcome to the second day of Free Thought Fest. Yay! Let's get started with the day. So our first speaker today is Mary Mogilevsky, and she runs the blog Brute Reason, where she talks about social justice, psychology, mental health, sexuality, and other topics. Today she will be talking about why kindergartners need sex ed, and she cares about giving people tools to live more happily, think more clearly, and act more ethically. This past year in July, when a few AHA officers went to the Secular Student Alliance Conference in Ohio for leadership training, we met Mary there. Later on, we talked a little bit on the phone about how we think it's really important to talk about sexual education, especially to people who are secular. So that's why she's here today. So give a warm welcome to Mary.
I know how microphones work. Hi, I am so happy to be here. Thank you for having me. It's my first time in Madison. I've been told to try cheese curds and ice cream, so I will be doing that. A little bit more about me. Or not, maybe? Okay. A little bit more about me, besides what you just heard in the introduction. I am a therapist based on Columbus, Ohio. I work with a variety of adult clients in a community mental health center. So a lot of my perspective on sexuality is coming from my mental health and social work training. I've also been a sex educator. I did it in college as part of a peer education group. And that's really where I got my start in learning about kind of people get to adulthood with a lot of misconceptions about sexuality and relationships. And also, as mentioned, I'm a writer. Sexuality has been an interest of mine for a long time in that regard. So a bit of an overview of this talk. Sex education, I think, is an important topic to us as secular people and has been for a long time because the religious right, you know, has, I think, turned sex education in our schools into something of a farce. Abstinence only till marriage. If you lose your virginity, you are now sullied. Stuff like that. And I have another talk where I get more into that. But this time, I want to take it a step further and actually go ahead and talk about why sex education is not just for teenagers, right? It's not just a high school thing. In fact, we should be starting it as early as possible. We should be starting it when kids start school. So in this talk, I'll be discussing why we should start sex education in kindergarten and how we can do that effectively. I'll also be talking about a lot of the arguments that people make against that, right, and how we can respond to those, and some of the things that would make it challenging for us to implement this, and then what we as secular students, as secular people, can do to help. And at the end, I'll leave plenty of time for questions because I know people have a lot of questions about topics like these, so just try to hold your questions till the end. Just as a bit of a warning, you know, obviously I'm going to be talking about sex. I will also mention sexual assault and abuse, and I'll be discussing child sexual abuse specifically. So please feel free to leave the room at any time for any reason if you need to. You won't be judged for it. Please also feel free not to participate in the interactive activities for any reason if you don't want to. So can we get the computer to work? Thanks.
Click. Oh, and then they'll work now.
Okay. Awesome. So why should we teach sex ed to kindergartners? There are a lot of reasons for that, and I'm just going to be going over some of the main ones in this talk. As I kind of mentioned already, one of the main reasons is child sexual abuse. That's a reality that, tragically, a lot of children have to face. Another reason is that kids will be exposed to sexuality through media and through their peers, whether we tell them about it or not. It also makes a great foundation for the later sex education that they'll have in middle school and in high school. It's a great way to combat body shame. It takes into account children's sexual development and the fact that it doesn't just start at puberty. And most importantly, sex education isn't actually just about sex. In fact, as you'll see, the title of this talk is kind of a bit of clickbait. So the first reason, as I mentioned, is child sexual abuse. Parents and teachers have long assumed that there's no need to talk to kids about anything sex-related until they start to approach puberty because they won't have any interest in sex until then. First of all, that's
that's not even necessarily true, but also it ignores the fact that, unfortunately, many children don't get to choose when sexuality becomes personally relevant to them. And to be clear, sex education cannot prevent child sexual abuse. Nothing can do that other than holding abusers accountable. But it can ensure that kids know that it's never their fault if someone chooses to hurt them, and that they can always tell an adult they trust if someone is hurting them. Some children who experience sexual abuse do not realize until much later that there's anything wrong with what's happening to them, because the abuser might be telling them that it's totally okay, and that person might also be the only one who's talking to them about sex at all. We have to make sure that kids know that nobody ever has a right to their body, no matter how much authority that person has over them. So the next reason is that kids will be exposed to sexuality sooner or later, and probably sooner. Raise your hand if you remember learning what sex is. So that's a lot of you. Keep your hand up if you learned about it from a parent or from some other authority figure. A few, okay. How about from a friend or a classmate? More, okay. And how about from books, TV, the internet, or other media? Okay. And for those of you who remember, how old were you? You can go ahead and shout it out.
8 or 9, 5, 8, 12.
That's earlier than high school. I'm hearing as young as 5, 8 or 9, 12. So I remember learning about blowjobs in fifth grade when I overheard a boy in my class telling another boy, "I could totally go for a BJ right now." And now I know, it was ridiculous. Now, I'm not that old, but that was back in the days of dial-up and Internet Explorer, so few of us were learning about sex online. Nowadays, it probably happens even younger. So that means that starting sex ed earlier than we've typically thought necessary is actually really important. I mean, I'm not saying we should be teaching fifth graders about blowjobs necessarily, but we should teach them about consent. We should make sure that it's okay that they know to come to adults with questions if they need to. We need to give them the tools to think critically about what they're gonna encounter online and kind of elsewhere. Because the sooner we start talking about bodies and consent and boundaries, the sooner we make sure that kids know that these are topics that they can come to us about. If we never talk about it, if we treat it as taboo, then when they do encounter a classmate talking about blowjobs, why would they come to us for any help? To that, starting sex education early makes for a great foundation for later learning. So everyone, kids included, learns best through repetition. Even the best sex ed curriculum won't be that helpful if kids only get it for a semester or two, like in seventh or eighth grade. They won't be able to connect it with anything they learned before, and without anything to follow it up, they'll quickly forget it after. And if you think about it, in other subjects like math and reading and social studies, kids start learning the simplest basics early on, and then they gradually build off of that every year. So first they do basic arithmetic, and then they move on to geometry and algebra and calculus. Sex ed should work the same way. So for instance, in kindergarten, sex ed would be focusing on saying no, respecting others' boundaries, understanding their own bodies. By the time kids start learning about sex and sexual health for real in middle and high school, they already have that strong foundation, those years of instruction that emphasizes consent and bodily autonomy. They'll also be accustomed to talking about these difficult topics with teachers and classmates. I think those of you who remember sex education in middle or high school, you probably remember a lot of awkwardness and giggling and stuff like that. I think that if we start earlier, that gives kids time to get used to how it feels to talk about those things. Another really important objective of sex education is combating body shame. For young children, sex education will focus on teaching them correct names for all of their body parts and helping them say those names without embarrassment. Because words like penis, vagina, and other body parts associated with sex are often considered profane in our society, which really is itself a reflection of kind of our regressive attitude towards sex, so many parents teach their kids to refer to their genitals and bodily functions using euphemistic, sing-songy kinds of words. And the intent, obviously, you know, it's usually not to shame kids, it's just to keep them from getting in trouble in school by talking about their penis or vagina. But the message that kids get is these things are wrong to talk about, and that you can only talk about them by pretending that you're talking about something else or by keeping it very vague. And for kids, it's a short step from that to the idea that those parts themselves are gross and wrong somehow and we shouldn't speak of them. Obviously, body shame is about much more than just calling your penis your wee-wee, and it will take a lot more to dismantle it than calling a penis, but it's a good place to start, and plus it prepares kids to take care of their bodies later on by learning all the correct names for its parts. So the next reason to teach kindergartners sex ed is that children are in many ways sexual beings, and I say this very cautiously because this type of reasoning is sometimes used to justify adults being sexual with children, which is abuse and never okay. But for many children, you know, they do feel a sense of sexuality before puberty. At kindergarten age, kids aren't generally sexual in the way most teenagers are, unless they've experienced sexual abuse, but they tend to be quite aware of which parts of their bodies are interesting, taboo, and feel good. It's not uncommon for kids to compare parts of their bodies with their friends or play doctor. And while this is understandably concerning to a lot of adults, there's not necessarily anything unhealthy or abnormal about it. It's part of how they explore and learn about their bodies, and most, you know, psychologists and other child development folks see that as kind of a developmental stage for a lot of kids. And the fact that this happens is a really important reason for kids to learn about boundaries and things like that early on. You know, like sex education can help kids understand that it's never okay to touch someone else's body without their permission, and that nobody ever has to let you touch or look at their body. So finally, the most important reason to start sex ed in kindergarten is because it's not actually all about sex. When done right, sex education is really more like life education. It's not just condoms, STIs, and pregnancy, especially not at that age. It's consent, it's communication, it's knowing that your body belongs to you and only to you. It's healthy relationships, it's not blaming yourself when others choose to hurt you, and knowing that it's okay to ask for help. Kids who get this type of education from an early age will be better prepared to interact with others in all sorts of contexts that have nothing to do with sex, and they will carry that with them into adulthood and into the rest of their lives. So then, how do we do it? There's three things I'll talk about here about sex education for young kids. It should be age appropriate, it should be comprehensive, and it should be interactive, which we'll get to in a moment. So what does age appropriate mean? That's one of the most common words you hear when talking about sex education. And like I've kind of been saying, we're not gonna be talking about sex in kindergarten. That's not really age appropriate. That said, it's important to acknowledge that the whole concept of age appropriateness is actually really slippery, and it's really dependent on a lot of cultural factors, even when we try to ground it in scientific evidence. A lot of people have very, very strong opinions on what is and isn't appropriate for children at particular ages. But when you ask them why it's so obvious to them that that's how it is, they don't necessarily have a good answer. That doesn't mean that their opinions are invalid. It just means that reasonable and well-meaning adults are going to disagree on this, including adults who study child development and psychology and sexuality. Different kids develop differently, and child development itself isn't linear. Children may develop the capacity to understand and grapple with various sexual topics at totally different ages. And while it's tempting to postpone some of these topics as long as possible so that everyone can kind of catch up, that can also do a lot of harm to children who are then left without the tools to navigate their social world. So, for example, you know, if I wanted to lay it out in a really general way, elementary school might be a good time to teach kids about asking for consent, saying no, being aware of their bodies and feelings, naming the parts of the body, and respecting the way others feel and identify. Middle school is a good time to teach kids about how their bodies will change during puberty, how reproduction works, how to recognize unhealthy relationships, and towards the end, how to avoid pregnancy and STIs. Some teens do become sexually active in middle school or soon after high school starts, so this isn't something that can necessarily wait. So then, by high school, teens can be learning about sexual and relational violence and abuse, bystander intervention, and making difficult decisions about sex and relationships. These are just a few examples, and they're not comprehensive. But the point is that as children and teens grow in their ability to process complex and emotionally challenging information, their curriculum kind of grows right along with them. And speaking of comprehensive sex education usually refers to the alternative to abstinence sex education. So the idea is, rather than just teaching kids that sex causes pregnancy and STIs, and that the only surefire way to avoid that is to stay abstinent until marriage, because I guess after marriage there's no STIs anymore or something. In comprehensive sex ed, we also teach about safer sex and contraception from a positive point of view. Not as in like, okay, if you have sex, use condoms, I guess. But like, okay, here are the ways to keep yourself safe, right? Not just condoms, but also other methods and other types of barriers. So that's obviously a really good start and something that unfortunately a lot of schools still haven't implemented. But it should actually be much, much more than that. And if we're talking about starting in kindergarten, there's even more to cover. Aside from setting boundaries and avoiding STIs in pregnancy, kids and teens should at some point be learning about reproductive health and LGBTQIA identities and gender expression and healthy relationships and intimate partner violence and masturbation and bystander intervention and how drugs and alcohol impact consent and sexism and other forms of oppression based on gender and sexuality and a whole lot of other things. So obviously that's a lot of stuff. But thankfully, we don't have to cover all of this in kindergarten. In fact, we probably shouldn't. So, and the last component is that it should be interactive. Most people of all ages learn best when there's an interactive component. And with early childhood sex education especially, we're basically talking about social skills. And the best way to learn them is to practice. So raise your hand if you've ever practiced mindfulness meditation. A lot of you, cool. So it's a bit of a buzzword these days, but all it really means in a mental health context is learning to be aware of what you're feeling without judging it or trying to change it. Mindfulness is a great thing to teach kids because it helps them develop that self-awareness, which in turn helps them recognize when they're uncomfortable or when they need to set a boundary with someone. There are a lot of different ways to practice mindfulness, but one of the simplest is called the body scan. And it's basically exactly what it sounds like. You mentally kind of scan each part of your body in turn and focus on how it feels. So we're going to try a body scan exercise that's specifically written for kids. Notice how it gently guides them towards paying attention to how their bodies feel and encouraging them to accept rather than judge those feelings, even when that feeling is distraction or inattention. So this is written for if they have an opportunity to lie down on something comfortable, which obviously you don't unless you want to lie down on the floor. So to start, lie down on your back or lean back in your chair. Let your legs and your arms relax and fall to your sides. Settle yourself in a comfortable position and close your eyes. Start by taking 2 or 3 gentle, large breaths. Pay attention to how that feels. Your belly rises and falls. Air moves in and out of your body. If you like, place a hand on your belly and feel it move with each breath. Now we're going to pay attention to the other parts of the body. Start with your feet. They might feel warm or cold, wet or dry, relaxed or restless. It's also okay if you feel nothing at all. If you can, relax your feet now. If that's hard to do, that's fine. Take a moment and notice how that feels too. For these few minutes, let yourself be still. There's nothing to do. Pay attention as best you can. You might feel a blanket or socks on your feet, or you might feel them pressing against the bed or the floor. When your mind gets busy, gently bring your attention back to your feet again. Now move your attention to your lower legs, noticing whatever is there. Do they feel heavy, light, warm, cold, or something else? Let go of frustration and trying to do anything. Just do your best and give yourself a few moments of rest. Next, move your attention to your knees and relax them. Feel the front, back, and sides of your knees. After a few more breaths, move your attention to your upper legs. Whatever you feel or don't feel, is fine. Notice your legs and let them relax. If you feel restless or wiggly, that's okay too. That happens. Now, move your attention to your belly. It always moves when you breathe, rising and falling like waves on the sea. You might feel something on the inside, like full or hungry. You might notice the touch of your clothing or a blanket. You might even feel emotions in your belly, like happy or sad or upset. If you feel that it's hard to focus, that's normal. Gently practice coming back again and again to how it feels when you breathe. Next, bring your attention to your chest. Notice it rising and falling as you breathe. If you feel that it's hard to focus, that's normal. Gently practice coming back again and again to how your chest feels when you breathe. Now turn your attention to your hands. There's no need to move them or do anything with them. They may be touching the bed or the floor or somewhere on your body. Relax them if you can, and if not, simply pay attention to your hands for another moment. Move your attention up into your arms. Maybe notice if you can find a moment of stillness inside you, like the pause at the end of each breath. Next, move your attention around to your back. How does it feel against the bed or the floor? Notice how it rocks with each breath. When your mind gets busy or angry or scared, you can always come back to how your body feels in this way for a moment. Now move attention to your neck and shoulders, letting go and relaxing them. If your mind wanders, that's fine. No one can pay attention all the time. Just keep returning to noticing your body whenever you find yourself thinking of something else. And now feel your face and head. What expression do you have right now? What would it feel like to smile? What else do you notice in your face, your head, and in your mind? Finally, spend a few moments paying attention to your whole body. If it's easier, continue to pay attention to your breath. If it's time for sleep, let that happen, remaining still and continuing to pay attention to your breath or feelings in your body. And if it's time to wake up, open your eyes and sit for a few moments before deciding when to move again. So that's our mindfulness exercise. And that's something that, you know, can be done with kids as a practice, you know, to help them get better and better at focusing and at paying attention to how they feel without judging. Because I think, I mean, it's hard for us a lot of time to pay attention to it because maybe we feel bad or maybe it's a little boring at first. But for kids especially, but the more that they learn to focus on their actual feelings, the easier it'll be for them to communicate that to others, even when those feelings are bad. So the next activity that we have is saying no, and all it really is practicing saying no. So if you're sitting near someone, turn to that person, or you can be in a group of three if you need to be, and I want you to practice asking each other for something, whether it's like a favor, help with homework, a date, whatever, and then the other person has to say no. And what you should really try to do is use the word no when you say no. Because a lot of times we do what's called the soft no. You know, someone says, hey, do you wanna, you know, come to the movies tonight? And we say, oh, I'm actually really busy. I have a lot of work to do. What word is missing from there? No. And obviously, you know, we know what this means. We understand that that's a no. But for kids especially, and around difficult things like, you know, our bodies and boundaries and sexuality, it's really important to teach kids to be direct. So try that now, and then you can switch.
Okay. you want to come up and be a volunteer with me?
Do I still have to say no?
Yes.
No, I don't want to do that.
Awesome. No, you can't have my shoes. I really like them. Had a chance to say no to someone. How did that feel?
Easy.
Anyone have a hard time? Yeah, I'm seeing some nods. I heard a lot of people asking questions that were like very obviously no. Like Rebecca asked me if she can have my shoes. I said no. Sorry. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of a fun exercise because it's practice, right? We're usually not asking for something that we seriously need or seriously want. It's just for practice. And I think that's really important because it helps kids get used to the whole concept of like looking someone in the eye and saying, no, I'm sorry, I can't do that for you. I can't do that with you. And hopefully the more we practice things like that, the easier it'll be to do it when the stakes actually are high. So the next activity is kind of similar. I call it saying stop. And for this, I need two volunteers to come up to the front. Anyone else? So I'd like you both to stand about, so you can stand here and you can stand over here, like across from each other. So, and I want you both to slowly walk towards each other, maintaining eye contact, until one or both of you gets uncomfortable with the closeness, and then you say stop, and then you have to stop. So start now.
Stop.
This activity is, first of all, to help people learn how to say stop when they feel like someone's getting too close to their personal space. But also, we'd be doing this in a classroom with a bunch of kids. And what they would get to see is that people say stop at different points of distance, right? Like, you guys were pretty close. Do you know each other?
No.
Oh, well, that's cool. So you don't know each other, but you know, we're at this conference together. I think there's some amount of trust that gets built up as a result of that. But people might, you know, kids might see that their personal bubble gets bigger when it's someone that they don't know, when it's maybe when it's someone of another gender, or maybe someone of the same gender. They might think that their bubble is bigger that day because they're just in a bad mood, or maybe their bubble is smaller that day because they're in a good mood. And what that helps to do is to teach kids that our comfort with physical closeness varies, and that we should still respect each other's boundaries, even if someone else's bubble seems really big to you. So thank you, you can have a seat. So the last activity I suggest we're not actually going to do because there wasn't a practical way to do it. But this is something that a lot of sex educators do, and it's called the anonymous question box. So what happens is that the teacher, the presenter, has a box that they put up front at the beginning, and they give all the students or children index cards to write anonymous questions on that they can then submit into the box at any point during the lesson. Then at the end, the teacher takes them all out and reads them and does their best to answer them. What a lot of teachers who do sex ed with kids find is that they expect to get a ton of questions about sex and, you know, kind of like the nitty gritty of that. But they often find that they get a lot of questions about relationships. Like, what do I do if I have a crush on someone? Or how do I get over it when someone won't go out with me? I think questions that a lot of kids would be embarrassed to ask out loud, maybe,
But sometimes it is about sex, sometimes it is about puberty, and it just helps take that whole embarrassment factor out. Of course, ideally, if we do this with kids all the time, if sex education becomes something that we start very early on, maybe some of that embarrassment will go away. But it might never go away entirely, and that's okay. You know, you don't have to put yourself out there and ask the question in front of your whole class. So why don't some people agree that we should do sex ed in kindergarten? There's a lot of reasons, and I'll just go over a few of them. A lot of people say that that should be the parents' job, right? It's not the job of teachers or schools. A lot of people say that it encourages boundary setting, and that's a bad thing, which obviously sounds really weird to me and probably to most of you, but I'll talk about that more in a little bit. Some people also oppose any kind of early sex education because they think it encourages earlier sexual behavior. And I'll go over why that's not entirely true either. So first of all, a lot of people say that this type of material should be up to parents. Nothing to do with schools or teachers. It's an especially common argument for sex education for older kids and teens, but it also applies to the types of things that we'd be teaching in kindergarten. The most obvious counter argument to that is that not all children have parents who are able or willing to teach them this material. And if we as a society decide that only parents have the right to teach this material, we're essentially punishing the kids whose parents can't or won't. And as I'll get to in a moment, the parents who make these arguments aren't necessarily demanding the right to teach their own kids about consent. After all, that's something they're perfectly able to do in conjunction with school-based sex ed. Rather, they're usually demanding that kids not learn this material at all. Imagine if a parent insisted that they just don't want their kid learning arithmetic or reading. That would be ridiculous. And consent is just as important as either of those things. Consent and sex education more broadly is a public health issue. It should be mandatory for the same reason that I believe that vaccines should be mandatory. Because if you don't do it, that not only harms you, but it also harms the people around you. If I had kids, I wouldn't want them going to school with a ton of kids who don't know that no means no, any more than I'd want them going to school with a bunch of kids who haven't had any of their vaccines. That's why this isn't just a parent's job. It's our job as a society to raise children who consent and respect boundaries. And as I mentioned, some parents don't necessarily like the idea of kids getting too comfortable saying no. There are actually a lot of times when we violate children's boundaries for no good reason, forcing them to hug and kiss relatives, demanding that they share toys for the sake of being nice, tickling them even though they don't want to be tickled, insisting that they be friends with kids they don't want to be friends with because that's the nice thing to do. If we teach kids that their bodies are their own and that nobody, not even a grown-up, can tell them what to do with their bodies, unless their health or safety is at stake, then yes, that's going to make things awkward when they won't hug grandma at Thanksgiving dinner. But if we want to raise healthy, consent-aware kids who turn into healthy, consent-aware adults, we're going to have to adjust some of our expectations. The last counter-argument is that some people say that this encourages early sexual behavior. Obviously, that's actually not true according to the evidence. If anything, good sex education tends to delay sexual activity, decrease the number of sexual partners that teens have, and like other positive effects like increasing safer sex behaviors. I always kind of hate talking about this though because I don't necessarily take it for granted that delaying sexual activity and having fewer partners is a good thing. Necessarily, but for the purposes of this argument, that's what appropriate sex education seems to accomplish. And in any case, at the kindergarten level, sex ed is more about teaching kids to say no than anything else. If there's any sex ed that encourages sexual activity, it's probably the kind of peer-based sex education that happens on many college campuses. For instance, as I mentioned, I was in a peer sex education group in undergrad, and we did workshops about sexual pleasure and kink and a lot of other stuff, but at that point, we were all adults. So some of the challenges to implementing sex education at the kindergarten level, the first one is politics. I'm not gonna lie, I don't see this happening on a large scale anytime soon. Our political situation is like the opposite of everything that we want.
even if you take sex out of the equation, and like I've been repeating a lot, we're not going to teach kindergartners about sex, there's still a lot of resistance to the idea of teaching kids about boundaries, and it's political resistance specifically. There's a disturbing tendency within conservative political discourse to regard the very idea of respecting people's boundaries and wishes as somehow suspect, a sign of weakness, as liberal propaganda. We're going to have to fight this if we want to get anywhere with any kind of sex education or consent culture. And as I mentioned before, a lot of the lessons that we should be teaching kindergartners about their bodies and boundaries are sort of at odds with the rest of what we teach them, right? For instance, young children are often exhorted to share their toys with any child, invite the entire class to their birthday party, and be friends with anyone who wants to be friends with them. I remember being creeped out when I had to write those little Valentine's Day cards to the entire class, regardless of who I actually had any warm feelings towards. And obviously, a lot of these practices are well-intentioned. We want kids to grow up being selfless and learning how to share. We don't want anyone to feel left out when they don't get invited to a classmate's birthday party or when they don't get a Valentine's Day card. But the problem is that we're teaching these things at the expense of children's boundaries. And while sharing a toy or writing a cute card isn't the same thing as going out with someone or having sex with them, young children tend to think in generalities. Someone wants this from me, and I don't want to be mean, so I should give it to them. That's a lesson that stays with children, especially girls and those perceived as girls, for a long time. So, and finally, there is a burden on teachers with this. K-12 teachers are already underpaid and overworked. If we make it a cultural norm to teach this type of sex education to kindergartners, that adds yet another burden onto their plates. It's no surprise that schools often bring in outside speakers to do assemblies on sex ed, given how busy teachers already are. Unfortunately, these speakers often espouse anti-scientific, sex-negative views that's based on abstinence till marriage. But even when the speakers are great, one or two assemblies isn't enough to teach kids and teens something as complex as this. We wouldn't teach any other subject that way. So we won't really be able to implement effective, comprehensive sex ed in any sort of meaningful way until we deal with some of the broader problems facing public education in our country, which unfortunately may not happen for the next 4 years. But there's still hope. So what can we do then? Well, as students, and many of you probably are, it may not seem like there's much you can do about this issue. And right now, maybe there isn't. But as you move on to your career and the rest of your life, you may be surprised at how many opportunities come up to help promote sex education for kids of all ages. First of all, obviously, if you become a parent or you help raise children as an older sibling, aunt or uncle, or godparent, you have a wonderful opportunity to use your critical thinking skills to teach kids good sex education. Respect children's boundaries. Thank them for saying no to you. Advocate for them if you notice other adults ignoring their boundaries. And when your children start school, advocate loudly that their school implement comprehensive sex education or improve the program that they already have. Schools hear from a lot of angry parents who oppose sex ed, whereas those who support it are more likely to just kind of shrug and teach it at home. Do that and also demand that everyone's kids get the same opportunities yours do. If you go into fields like education, social work, or healthcare, you may have an opportunity to interact with or teach kids directly. You can also work with or volunteer for nonprofits like Planned Parenthood and Advocates for Youth, which is an organization that advocates for effective sex education. You can also run for your local school board. School boards have a lot of influence over what's taught in schools and how. Sometimes it's more effective to make change on a local scale. But that said, it can also be a way to start off a career in politics or advocacy. Early childhood sex education matters because the earlier we start teaching children about boundaries and consent, the easier it will be for them to grow up with the confidence and self-awareness and sensitivity that it takes to say yes, say no, and respect both. When you interact with children, and almost all of us will at some point, remember that as an adult, you have the power and the privilege of helping them along that journey. Thank you. So if there's questions, we can take them up at this microphone.
You did a great job. I wonder if we could go back in time 60 years and you could give that presentation to my mother.
Not with today's technology, but maybe someday. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Kurt. It's way in the back there. I was wondering if you had any data or books or reading that you might suggest on this topic, things that you used for researching it.
So I do. I didn't put them in this talk because nobody ever looks at the references slide, so now I feel bad. But anyone who's interested in some of my citations and sources can come up and talk to me at any point during this conference. There's a lot of really wonderful books on this topic that, of course, I can't remember the authors off the top of my head. Also, some good research on kind of what good sex education accomplishes and what's effective. Also, there's a few great websites out there that aim to help parents or other caretakers teach kids at all levels about sexuality. So definitely come talk to me if you want to hear more about that.
Thanks so much for doing this talk. I heard you talk a little bit about the inclusion of pleasure discussions in sex education at the college level, but I did not hear you talk about that much at earlier levels. Are there good rational reasons to skip over covering pleasure at a younger age, or is it just politically sort of impossible at this point?
I think it's politically impossible at some point. I don't think we should skip it. And in fact, I did mention masturbation is a topic that should be covered at a fairly young age. And the reason I mentioned that is because kids will masturbate. Their parents will freak out about it. And I think it's important for us to teach kids that that is normal and that that is healthy and that you're not going to go blind or any of that weird stuff that they say will happen. But, I mean, the issue that Benny brings up of the politics is that, yes, it will be very, very difficult in our current political climate to ever put that through any kind of like school curriculum, which is really too bad. And what's interesting, one of the books that I was going to recommend to anyone who asks talks about sex education in the Netherlands and in other Northern European countries. And there they actually explicitly, it's in their textbooks, not just masturbation, but like what feels good for genitals and how do you do it, and there that's just considered part of growing up and learning about your body, whereas here it's some sort of big controversy for some reason. So thank you for asking that. I hope we can make that happen one day.
Hi, I'm Annie. Awesome presentation. Thanks.
Thank you.
I was just wondering if you had any tips in your past experience with when speaking to people that have totally different political ideologies than you, how you're able to get across the message that sex education is like so critical for future generations. How can you appeal to people?
So when I speak to people who like are very, I guess, like ideologically different from me, I usually go straight into practicality. Mm-hmm. I point out that no matter what your beliefs, the facts are that kids and teens will explore sexuality, and that because they're going to explore it, we have to make sure that they do it in as safe and a healthy way as possible. And that's also where those statistics about comprehensive sex ed come in. Like I said, it's not my goal to reduce the number of sex partners that people have. I don't care about that at all, as long as they're being safe and consensual, but that's a thing that a lot of more conservative people are very concerned with. And to show them research that shows like, hey, if we teach kids real information about sex as opposed, well, I mean, I wouldn't say real information if I was speaking to them, obviously. If we teach comprehensive sex ed rather than abstinence until marriage, it reduces the average number of sex partners and it delays sexual initiation, which is the scientific term for losing your virginity. So, yeah, focus on the facts.
Thank you.
We'll do one more.
So when you were doing the body scan, I noticed that you skipped the pelvic region. And I was wondering, because my experience with that was that it actually focused my attention on it more than if it had just been included. Is that because of actual child psychology and developmental reasons, or is it again because of politics and practicality, and if you do a body scan that says, notice your hips and your pelvic region, people are going to freak out?
That's a really good question. I didn't skip it on purpose. That was just when I was looking up body scans for children, you know, with language that would be simple enough for kids. Those are all the ones that I found. And that's really interesting, right? I actually didn't even think about that. It probably is intentional. It might not even be political so much as that if you say buttocks to a group of kids, they're all going to start giggling. Actually, if you say it to me, I'll probably start giggling. Which obviously kind of messes with the flow of the exercise for the whole class. But then again, then, you know, I was talking a lot before about how if we start this type of education early on and we get kids comfortable with talking about their bodies and things like that, that kind of giggly effect and that embarrassment might go away. And including, you know, buttocks or pelvis or whatever in a body scan wouldn't have any kind of effect. Mm-hmm. So I guess it would be up to the teacher to kind of read their own classroom and decide what would be best. I definitely don't think that we should just by default skip it, because that's silly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you for asking.
Can we have a hand for you?
Thank you, everyone.